Thanks again.
Started recording.
All right. So we are going to go through, as promised, the Higgs to Tau Tau example that we'll be using for your analysis flow. And then I would love to also talk about some of people's individual analyses. So hopefully, please be willing to raise your hands, and we'll collaborate a little bit on building your CMS analysis selection. So let's jump in to the first question. So the first thing we have to decide whenever we're building an analysis is what is our signal and what are we searching for? And so in this case, for Higgs to Tau Tau, there is a paper. This is the CMS paper that was published searching for Higgs decaying to a pair of tau leptons in this data set that we're able to consider now in open data. They have many, many channels. So they have each tau lepton decays hadronically or leptonically to an electron or a muon, leading to six different final states. We're just going to focus on one. It's very probable that this paper was put together by a team of different analysts. Perhaps, you know, you could imagine something like one graduate student per final state or something like that. To eventually build into this paper. So if you're considering a physics process that has a lot of different possible decays, often the easiest way to go forward is to break it down a little bit into things that are similar to each other and then recombine at the end. So we can look just at the Feynman diagrams to figure out what we expect. So these are the two Feynman diagrams that we'll consider. We've got either gluon fusion producing this Higgs boson, or we've got vector boson fusion producing this Higgs boson, and they might give us different final states. So of course, in the top Feynman diagram, the Higgs is produced by itself. In the lower Feynman diagram, the Higgs is produced along with two quarks, which will probably end up appearing in the CMS detector as jets. So given that we were told our final state is a hadronic tau and a tau that decays to muons, we certainly expect that we should be able to find that hadronic tau object. We should be able to find a muon. All of the neutrinos, at least the two neutrinos, should give some missing energy in the detector. And there may be a couple of jets. So there may be a couple of probably light quark jets if this vector boson fusion process is what happened to produce the Higgs boson. So based on these particles, which trigger or triggers would be useful to make sure we have our signal events represented in the data set? So is anyone willing to unmute or write in the chat, what was your idea for a Higgs to Tau Tau trigger that would be good for this final state? What type of objects might you want in your trigger? Okay, tau parked, tau plus X is starting to come in. These are what I would consider names of data sets. Names of data sets. And so that's very important. And you're absolutely correct. We'll end up looking at the tau plus X data set. But we could be more specific than X here for this final state. I don't have the menu to see if anybody's raised their hand. So I think we can be totally flexible and you can just unmute and speak if you would like to share anything in this session. Okay, so the obvious, shouldn't say it that way. the most straightforward thing we could do. Okay, glue glue to H to tau tau. That again is the name of like a, that might be our signal sample. That might be the data set we look up to be our signal sample. In terms of the actual trigger, we probably want something that's either going to give us taus, muons, or a combination of both. So this analysis is really perfect for a trigger, and our jargon for this is a cross trigger that has more than one object in it. And so the trigger that is that we'll end up using here looks like this. So the HLT path has an isolated muon with some criteria on it that we're about to talk about, and it requires a particle flow tau. So we have this combination of two objects. And so this is what I mean by the difference between a data set name and a trigger. We will certainly find this type of trigger in the tau plus X data set. We will certainly find that many events in the glue glue H to tau tau Monte Carlo sample pass this trigger. But this is an actual specific flag we can ask for that will give us a muon and a tau, which pretty well describes our final state. Okay, so which objects would we require? Did anybody come up with a hypothesis about what you might require for, let's just throw it out there, for your tau? How might you select a tau? Okay, Cecilia said with a muon or an electron. And so we know how the tau is going to decay. So we've already declared that one of them is going to decay hadronically, and one of them is going to decay to a muon. So the tau that decays to a muon, in terms of the CMS detector, shows up as a muon. Okay, we actually don't have a great way to tell that it was ever a tau. Because we aren't going to detect it in the detector as a tau, it will only look like a muon. So when we're asking the CMS software, when we're asking our root files about taus, we're getting the hadronic versions. So what we're going to need to do is look in these, we're going to need to look in these tau collections. So if I go, let me get my index for the lesson here. If we go back here, the muons and taus page will be a good reference for us for this analysis example. We're going to want to open, you know, this tau collection, particle flow tau producer. We're going to want to open this tau collection, and we're going to want to make selections on the objects there for our hadronic tau. Kind of similar idea for the muon. So we certainly need at least one muon, and we need one hadronic tau. Okay, so a muon means, you know, opening up our muon collection and looking through it. A hadronic tau means opening up our tau collection and looking through it. And if we wanted to target that vector boson fusion, let's say that's what I was interested in as opposed to the other type of production, then I would probably require that there are two jets. So that would be something to consider. You could also decide you're not interested, you want to try to get rid of vector boson fusion, you could reject jets. Okay, the last thing which Cecilia pointed out here on the chat, we will have some neutrinos. It's a little bit tricky to decide always whether we need a missing ET requirement. There are neutrinos involved. They might not have a very large momentum in this case. So we may have to study our signal to decide if it really helps us to use that type of condition. Okay, so let's do this. We've got, let's have this trigger, which has this language in it about a muon. So this language here refers to the muon. And this language here refers to the tau, the hadronic tau. So what kinematic criteria might you require for each object? So what did anyone come up with, let's say for the muon? Did anyone have a kinematic set of kinematic criteria that they were thinking of for the muon?
Would be nice to have an isolated muon.
Yes, I agree. That's not cool. That's kind of the next question. So what about things like literally kinematics?
A big angular gap between the two tau decays.
Okay, big angular gap between the two tau decays, so it should be separated from the hadronic tau. Mm-hmm. Any other kinematic criteria, such as momentum, places in the...
Well, if they come from the Higgs, you need the rest mass to be the Higgs.
Yep. Okay. Yep. So when we are looking at combining the different objects, so we're leaping ahead a little bit. let's stay way back down on just the muon itself, or just the tau itself.
So maybe a high momentum for both object.
A high-ish momentum for both objects. Absolutely a good idea. And what the real reason I asked this question is because I want to point out that a connection here to this trigger path. So we actually have some criteria that are already imposed on you by the fact that we have chosen a trigger. And this will happen almost always when you're selecting triggers for your analysis. There are some constraints. The trade-off in CMS is that, of course, we would love to just be able to save everything, right? But we can't. So we have to determine what our physics choices are in order to decide what events we save. And so it's easier to save all the events from a certain physics process if that physics process involves high energies, high momenta. And so the lower you try to go in your let's say energy requirements in a trigger, the more likely it is that you will end up with a trigger that is pre-scaled, which you learned about in your pre-exercise. And when you're doing an analysis, you tend to want to avoid that. You want to choose a trigger where you are going to actually select all of the data that came through that trigger, as opposed to some random subset of it. So this trigger language tells us that the muon selected by this trigger will have at least 17 GeV of energy, or excuse me, of transverse momentum. And this language here tells us that the muon will live in the central region of the detector. So if pseudorapidity starts at zero, here's my CMS detector, pseudorapidity starts at zero and goes towards infinity. 2.1 is basically this wedge, let's say, in the detector, of course, both top and bottom. So we automatically have some kinematic requirements that have been placed on our muon. We will lose all of the muons below 17 GeV. We will lose all of the muons that are at large pseudorapidities. We've got the same type of thing going on our tau, this label here, 20. Yep, question.
Do you necessarily lose them? Isn't this just what you trigger on? So couldn't there be other muons in the event that are below that criteria? Or?
That's true. There could be other. So thanks for correcting me. The trigger muon here is 17 GeV or more, and in this central region. So you have no guarantee of any muon that's at lower momentum and higher pseudorapidity, although of course they might exist.
That makes sense. Thank you.
Yeah. And same. And
sorry
same
to idea. Sorry to interrupt, Julie. And this is where the trigger object analyzer could come handy, because with that type of analyzer, you can actually make sure that the neon you triggered on is what you think it is.
Yep, absolutely. So, okay, so we talked about the muon. Same idea with our tau. Here we're being told that this trigger is selecting events that have a hadronic tau with a momentum of 20 GeV. And what's important to know is that whenever you're relying on a trigger to select objects for you, when it says 17 GeV, we would love for that to be a step function. Like this muon, if the highest momentum muon in the event is between 0 and 17, we get nothing. And then as soon as there's a 17 GeV muon, boom, we detect it and we trigger on it. That, of course, is too perfect of a scenario. So you should always imagine an error function in your mind. Sorry, I'm, at least on my screen, I'm drawing this backwards. So if I'm inverted, invert me in your brain. You should always imagine some sort of curvy turn on function in momentum when you're thinking about this. So what this usually means is that it, as analysts, it is safer to add a little momentum buffer on our selection. So if you go to this paper and you look at their table for how they are selecting the leptons, it will probably take me too long to find it right now. If you go to this paper and you look at what they're doing, in this channel, they require that the muons have, the leading muon has a momentum of at least 20 GeV instead of 17. And that the hadronic tau has momentum of at least 30 GeV instead of 20. So they've added a buffer here so that we have no, we're trying to avoid the uncertainty of how we select or don't select leptons kind of in that turn-on region. Any questions about this part? This is one of the things that's always difficult, especially, you know, as students in CMS, is figuring out how do we decode what these trigger phrases mean.
Yeah, so maybe just a quick question. Mm-hmm. We probably also want prompt leptons, but I don't know if that's something we apply at this step or when we're correlating objects together. Or would we just use like the impact parameter?
Yeah, so that's part of the next box here.
Okay.
Yep. There's a question in the chat. Why do we select different absolute eta for muon and for tau? That's a great question. Sometimes these decisions are driven by the detector itself. So for instance, jets have a different pseudorapidity acceptance region than muons do, because the muon detectors have a different pseudorapidity cutoff than the calorimeters do. So there are considerations like that. Jets will often be accepted at wider pseudorapidities. In this case, the muon detectors, we can actually select muons out to 2.4. This trigger has tightened that in. If you were unhappy with that, you could go searching for some different trigger that had a wider acceptance. You might have to trade off a higher momentum in order to get that.
And also the detectors have different technologies which span different subregions in ADA. And so those things are taken into account.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's now think, that's our kinematic criteria. Let's now think about the quality criteria. So we actually already had some discussion about this. The suggestion was that our muon in particular should be isolated. It should be separated from the other tau, which is absolutely correct. So how do we code those up into the identification and isolation criteria? Okay, we can think about them separately. Tau selection. So if we come back over here to muons and taus and we go to the Twiki page, we go to the Twiki page that has the big list of all the IDs. There's this great selection it's a flag called by decay mode finding. You will always want to use this. Okay, super. I trust you, Tau Pog. So we're always going to use that. So you'll find that we have, if you look at Poet, we've stored this this branch in our tree. And let's just take a peek. Let's take a look. I have the top quark pair file. I don't have the Higgs to Tau Tau file, but we can look at the taus. You know what? I'm probably not going to remember the names of the branches off the top of my head, so I'll grab the actual. Oh, come on. There we go. Let's grab the actual file. Let's see how many of these taus actually pass that requirement. I think we should have some taus in this sample. Here we go. Okay, ID decay mode. So actually we have a chunk of taus that we would just throw away because they don't pass this by decay mode finding. And then we have another requirement here again from our trigger. So the trigger says loose ISO PF tau. A loose ISO PF tau suggests that we should be looking at this tau ID that's based on isolation. Isolation again, meaning how separated is it from other things? And we should require that it is indeed separated from other things at least a loose level. So this is a kind of high efficiency, maybe lower purity, but somewhat reasonable efficiency flag. So in fact, we talked about a buffer on momentum. You can also put a buffer on the identification from the trigger, although that's a little bit less important. So the version of this analysis that you could find on the Open Data Portal will actually even require that the tight flag is fired, even beyond just being loose. And so then the other thing we want to know for sure in this specific analysis, because we have one hadronic tau and one muonic tau, we want to know that this was a real tau as opposed to being an electron or a muon that looks like a tau. And so to get rid of electrons or muons that look like taus, we have these other IDs called anti-electron or electron rejection, if you're looking at the Twiki, and anti-muon or muon rejection, if we're looking at the Twiki. And this is interesting, even to click here in the top quark sample, it's actually much more likely. You can see all the zeros here for electron rejection. If we compare that to the muons, my take on this is that it's much easier for electrons to mimic a hadronic tau, which has some sense to it because they're a calorimeter object as opposed to a muon. Okay. Muon selection, we don't have any information here in the trigger about what the ID should be for this muon, but we do see this phrase ISO. Okay, we do see that it's isolated. And so we should choose some criteria on the isolation, which we have stored in one of our branches. Okay, so we have some isolation variable here. And you can actually see we have a dummy column where we weren't able to calculate it for certain muons. So how could we decide what criteria we'll use? How did this analysis decide it should be less than 0.1? Well, again, the first place I would go back is to the muon Twiki page. And I would look up isolation. And they've given some recommendations. So actually here, the recommendation is even that the tight cut is 0.12. This analysis used a slightly smaller, slightly tighter requirement, perhaps because the recommendations were changing when they were doing their work. Okay, so we can make a choice on isolation based on what we learned from the trigger. The ID, we're not given any prompting. So here's my rule of thumb for you. In any analysis where you expect a prompt muon from your signal, from your decay of your heavy particle, tight is a really good way to go. Tight is a super way to go. And that's what we'll do in this example. So questions about this type of decision-making. How did we make these decisions? How would you replicate these decisions in your own analysis?
Sorry, I have a question regards to that. These cuts or these requirements are available for data sets or real collisions or only the simulate data set?
None of these decisions rely on us knowing anything about the simulation truth. So anytime you find yourself tempted to make a requirement that actually requires you to know, to look up something about the generator status of any of your particles, you want to avoid that because you won't be able to make that same selection in data. So all of these things can be applied in exactly the same way on real data and simulated data.
Okay, because I think in the in this possibility, when I have, for example, tau decay into one hadron, maybe a pion and a neutrino, okay? For this decay in MC dataset, we can impose for example, one requirement with respect to the MC mode. For example, the one prong or two prong or three prong. But in this case, I can see that. So for the reason, it's my question.
Okay. Yeah, so I would avoid that type of way of thinking about selecting your events. You would want to recast the way you think about selecting hadronic taus to things that can be to things that could be pulled out using all of the discriminators that they have trained, which don't tend to separate the different types of prongs hadronically, if that makes sense. So we have things based on isolation and we have ways to tell against electrons and muons, but I think it's not common to try to split a detector-based tau analysis into different number of hadronic prongs.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm. That's a really good question. Okay. So the last question I've asked here about signal, are there any correlations between your object that you might exploit? And one got posited earlier, was that we should expect that when we combine this muon and this tau, we get a Higgs boson. And that's a great idea. And it's hard, in this case, it's hard to do because we have those neutrinos. So in this specific case, I would say absolutely, let's just make a Higgs mass window if we were doing leptons, all charged leptons. But in this case, with the tau decaying to neutrinos, we've lost some information because we have only the visible part of the decay available to us in a usable format. So we are probably not going to find a very clean Higgs mass peak in this analysis. But are there any other correlations that anyone was able to think of that you would expect between these objects? there's a kind of sneaky one hiding in there that you actually might not think of immediately. But we even though we have trouble accessing all of the mass, we do have the ability to measure the charge of both of these objects. We can measure the muon charge and the tau charge. And so we can ask that they have opposite charges. So that's one thing that will help us reduce some background and target our signal, because we can at least expect that the two objects should make a neutral parent particle. So that's one correlation between the objects that we can absolutely exploit. Okay. All right, what time is it? It is 9:45 and we're going, so we're like out of time. Okay, so let's keep going then. I apologize. I really wanted to take the time to talk through someone's individual analysis, but maybe we'll do that offline. If anyone wants to talk through their analysis selection, we can do that together. So backgrounds. What will mimic our signal is the question. So you can obviously start with just consider the entire standard model and try to figure out what will sneak in. So good rule of thumb is to say, what would give me the same final state, maybe with a few extra things, or maybe missing a few things? Because it's always possible that you get extras for free from QCD. And it's always possible that you just miss things in your selection. So Cecilia has said zeta tau 100% is the biggest background for this process, because it's identical. The only thing that's different is the fact that we've got this, probably some different production going on, but the Z will have different properties. So what I wanted to do in this solution is link you to the Open Data Portal page for this analysis that you can look at more later. And they have listed out what the background processes are. And bingo, the most dominant one is zeta tau tau. Zeta leptons will probably also sneak in there, because we could, by mistake, call some of these leptons a tau. W plus jets will probably sneak in there. It certainly can produce muons. One of the jets could be mistaken as a tau, all of those type of things. So we've got the big hitters here. Z, W, top quark pairs, and of course, just multi-jet production, multiple jets. By accident, we get a muon, and by accident, we get something that looks like a tau. But this process has such a humongous cross-section in proton collisions that all of those tiny, rare accidents will certainly show up. Okay. So based on these processes, which simulations should we include? We talked about this a little bit in Matt's challenge. So similar logic, once you've decided on a standard model process to include, you can go finding the simulated data sets for it. The one holdout is this QCD. So when we say QCD, we just mean jets showing up, randomly. And that one is difficult to model in simulation. So in CMS physics analyses, we rarely rely on the simulation to model that background. It is much preferable to try to find some way to use the data itself to model that type of background, which we'll talk about more in later lessons. Okay, so should we apply any upper or lower limits on the number of certain physics objects? So that's one way you can try to get a handle on your backgrounds, is to actually think out, is it worth it for me to say, I'm not going to allow there to be five, there must only be two, or I'm not going to allow there to be three, there must only be one. That's hard to give a rule of thumb, but you should certainly study your signal samples and your background samples to determine if that would help you. In this, it can be helpful, but it would be analysis based. In this case, when we do Higgs to tau tau with one hadronic and one muonic tau, we're not going to specifically veto, which is the jargon word veto, we're not going to veto on additional leptons. We're just going to look for events that have at least one good muon, at least one of these good taus, and work on combining them. Okay, are there any objects we should veto? So based on this list of backgrounds, we've got a couple more minutes left. I think we have enough time for this question. So based on our list of backgrounds here, is there anything that stands out as something we might be able to get rid of by specifically rejecting certain objects?
Yeah, anything that reconstructs the invariant mass of a Z? Well, any two charge tracks.
Anything that reconstructs the invariant mass of the Z? That is certainly something we could explore. One question you might want to answer first is look at your signal and see how much of your signal overlaps down into that mass range.
If you have too many jets.
And events with too many jets. Yep, if we have some event with 10 jets, it's probably not Higgs to tau tau. We could do a cut. Mm-hmm. Taus with the same charge. Yep, so we did talk about that. We'll use opposite charge requirement. The one that I pulled out, I think you guys are all correct, because there's not a strict right or wrong answer here. I think you guys are all correct. One that stands out is this TT bar, which has most likely has B tagged jets in it. So jets that look as though they come from bottom quarks is a good handle we could have to get rid of those top quark background events. And that's what the actual CMS paper did. They rejected events with top quark. Excuse me, they rejected events with jets that look like bottom quarks. Okay, and then actually in the published analysis, the categories that were doing VBF used a jet veto, as was just suggested. They looked specifically in the center region of the detector and said there should not be many jets there other than anything that might be overlapping the leptons or the tau. Okay, and then correlations between objects in the background that might be useful for rejection. So given the time, I'm just gonna click this open. There's one other background that we can get a good handle on, and it's W. When we have this tau decay, we're getting two neutrinos out. And so that kind of, anytime you have multiple disappearing objects, the missing ET kind of gets scrambled and it doesn't represent just one object. So it's difficult to use it straight away to analyze any specific, let's say, mass. In the case of the W, it's a little bit different because we expect that we have our lepton, let's say in this case, the muon, and the missing energy should form that W, which would not be the case in a Higgs event. So we can actually form what we call a transverse mass. And so you can look that up in the paper. The transverse mass between the muon and the missing ET tends to give you something that's quite near the W boson mass, even though we're missing the Z information, the longitudinal information from the neutrino. It tends to be quite close. And so we could actually say, let's make sure we're down low. Let's make sure that the transverse mass here between our muon and our neutrinos looks very small, because it should not give us anything that's W-like. So that's the last analysis requirement that was put on this channel by the paper. We have the individual selections for muons, for taus, require them to be the same charge, require that this transverse mass of the muon and missing ET is small to get rid of W background, reject B-tagged jets to get rid of top quark background, and in the case of vector boson fusion, reject extra jets in the central region of the detector. And that's how they put things together. So the summary here, Is to pay attention to your triggers. When you choose a trigger, you usually have imposed on yourself some kinematic requirements. Pay attention to which final state objects should be prompt. Impact parameter is usually wrapped into those identification criteria. A typical prompt final state particle would have some significant momentum, be tight qualities, and it may or may not be isolated based on your physics process. If you're going to veto on objects to get rid of them, you tend to want that process, that condition to get rid of background, usually want it to be a very high efficiency criteria. So we'll often veto on things with a loose identification criteria. And we can always look for correlations between objects to select or reject based on whatever we want to do. And in all these, for all these conditions, you can study your signal, you can study your backgrounds to try to balance that trade-off of keeping your signal events and discarding your background events. Okay. Any last questions based on this decision-making procedure before we move on to the next lesson? Okay, I don't hear.
So let's stop the recording before we begin the next session.